Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. More than $1 billion has been spent on autism research during the last 10 years. Is it the father? Is it the mother? Is it the environment or drugs that we take for other ailments? What causes autism? Some in the field of autism research say that the question marks may soon be replaced with some answers. They predict a new wave of science that should put some notions to rest and bolster others. Later this hour, we're going to hear from a neuroscientist about research breakthroughs on Fragile X syndrome, the most common known single gene cause of autism, and we'll talk with the parent of two sons with Fragile X syndrome. Joining us now by phone from Sacramento, California, is David Amaral. He's professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences, and he's also director of research at University of California, Davis Mind Institute. He is the past president of the International Society for Autism Research. Welcome to the show, David.
Good morning, Ann.
You say things are moving fast in the autism world. Last month, an AP reporter said that more than $1 billion, as I said earlier, has been spent researching it in the last 10 years. And some experts say they are seeing the beginning of a wave of scientific reports that should strengthen some theories, jettison others, and perhaps even herald new drugs. Do you agree we're on the verge of major breakthroughs?
I do. Beginning in about 1995, there was several groups in the United States, parent advocate groups, that really mobilized research on autism. And just as one indication, in the 1990s, if you went to the Library of Medicine, you would find that there would be something on the order of 100 to maybe 200 papers published on any aspect of autism every year. But by contrast, last year there were 2,900 scientific papers on autism. And what I think has happened is we've gotten more mindful and more aware of how complicated this disorder really is.
Before we talk about the research breakthroughs, let's say, what is autism? It's not one disease. It's not one cause. Everyone pretty much agrees on that.
Yeah, that's right. All individuals with autism have common characteristics. To get a diagnosis of autism, you have to have behavioral impairments in social interaction. There's generally a problem with communication, and it could either be verbal or nonverbal communication. And then there's repetitive behaviors, movements, or sometimes very specific interest. Children with autism, for example, will often line up cars in a row and do it over and over and over again. Those are what we call the core features of autism. And those are all a result of some impairment in brain function. In the early days of autism, people thought, well, maybe this has a psychological cause. But in fact, the modern view is that autism is a biomedical disorder. It is caused by a malfunction of the brain in ways that we're still trying to figure out. The problem is that it's extraordinarily heterogeneous in the sense that a particular individual who has what we now are calling autism spectrum disorder can have various levels of disability in each of those core features that I mentioned. But even what makes it more complicated is that most individuals with autism have associated problems as well, which we call comorbid syndromes. And these can range from epilepsy, which is found in about 30% of people with autism, to gastrointestinal problems, something on the order of 25% of all individuals with autism have profound gastrointestinal problems, to what is now called developmental delays, but used to be called mental retardation. And something on the order of 40 to 50% of people with autism have developmental disabilities. So, it's very, very complicated. It is currently diagnosed behaviorally. We don't have a biomarker for it. We can't do a blood test for it. What researchers and clinicians have been trying to do over the last 10 to 15 years is to come to terms with the complexity of this disorder.
My guest is David Amaral. He's professor of psychiatry and director of research at UC Davis Mind Institute. We're talking about autism this hour. If you have a question or comment for David, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org, and you can go to our All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page as well. Because it's behaviorally diagnosed, that's a problem because usually the behaviors don't emerge or the identifiable behaviors don't emerge until they're older.
Yeah, well, that's partially true. Okay. And there are people across the country now that are looking for the earliest signs of autism because, and I'll get back to the earliest signs in a moment, but just to say that the treatment currently for autism that's most effective is a behavioral treatment, which is a variant of what's called applied behavior analysis. Basically, the children have fairly intensive, that is 20 to 40 hours a week of learning therapy, and essentially are taught to do things that come naturally to other people, things like making eye contact, taking turns in terms of communications, and learning to read and things like that. So what we know is that the earlier the intervention gets started, the less likely that there will be disability or the disabilities will be reduced. So, you know, the question you raise is, when can you first detect autism? And the current literature suggests that at 6 months, there really isn't anything that you can see in the behavior of the child that would lead you to believe that they're going to go on to have autism or any other problem for that matter. At 12 months, there are some children at least that are starting to show some concerning problems, but those problems don't reliably determine whether the child is going to have autism or some other developmental delay or, for example, language disability. It really isn't only until 18 to 24 months when a diagnosis of autism can be made that is very reliable. And there does seem to be, though, even two forms of the onset of autism. So for some children, if you look at their first birthday videos at 12 months, you can see that something seems to be wrong. They're not enjoying the party. If somebody calls their name, they don't look at that person. And it really becomes clear that there is a problem. And we would call that an early onset form of autism. But then there's another group of children who, at their first birthday videos, they look perfectly fine. They have a few words. They're making social contact with the other participants in the party. They're having a good time. And for those children, they may not show any problems until 18 to 24 months when they'll start losing language, losing social ability, and they regress into autism. And so, broadly speaking, we think of autism as having either an early onset or a regressive form. And, of course, one of the big questions is there any biological difference that distinguishes those two forms of autism?
Let's get to some of the top 10 research findings of 2011. These were selected by Autism Speaks. It's the nation's largest autism science and advocacy organization. It funds research into the causes, prevention, treatments, and a cure for autism. First one in July, the largest study of twins with autism reported some important results. Can you tell us about that, David Amaral?
Yeah, this was really a game changer in a sense. Up until that study, it was thought that autism was a highly heritable genetic disease. The earlier studies suggested that if one identical twin had autism, the other one would have autism 90% of the time, which was one of the most heritable of psychiatric diseases that we know about. The earlier literature also suggested that if you had non-identical twins, that the chance that they would both have autism was actually pretty low, around 5% or less. But this new paper, which was a study of a large group of twins, 192 twin pairs, found on the one hand that if one identical twin had autism, the chance of the other identical twin having autism was only around 60%, and that on the other hand, that if the twins were non-identical or fraternal twins, that the risk of them both having autism was much higher than we previously thought, more like 30%. And so the conclusion from this study was that while certainly genetics increases the risk of a child having autism, that the environment, and particularly the maternal environment, was also a substantial contributor to risk. And I think that this speaks to an issue that has really evolved over the last 10 or 15 years, and that is that even though there are going to be genes where if there's a problem with the gene or a mutation, the child may be at greater risk, that there are probably going to be a whole series of environmental factors, and these can range from antibodies in the mother during pregnancy to environmental toxicants, to even things like diet or, as you said, maternal age and paternal age that can contribute to autism as well. And again, at the moment, we're trying to figure out, which genes are risk factors and which environmental factors are also playing a role as well. Unfortunately, the genetic picture keeps getting more and more complicated. It used to be thought, I think even as recently as 10 to 15 years ago, that maybe there would be an autism gene, a single gene, or maybe a small number of genes that if you had problems with those genes or mutations, that would cause autism. What we currently know is that there are probably a couple of hundred genes that if you have a mutation can increase slightly the risk of having autism. But you can find those same mutations in people that don't have autism. So none of the genes that we know about at this point in time are actually determinant of having autism. So in your next segment, for example, Fragile X, we know the Fragile X mutation, and you'll hear more about that. But it turns out that if you have the Fragile X mutation, it puts you at higher risk for having autism. So about 30% of people that have Fragile X also have autism. But interestingly, 70% who have Fragile X don't have autism. And if you look at it the other way around, if you ask the question, how many people with autism have the Fragile X mutation, it accounts for about 2 to 3% of all autism. And again, any gene that we know about usually accounts for only about 1 to 2% of the individuals with autism. So the complexity of the genetic picture is enormous, even to the point that we now know that, when you say something is hereditary, you always think of something coming from the mom or the dad. But we now know that there are what are called de novo or brand new mutations, so that you could have the mom or the dad conceive a child, and the problems with the DNA happen when after the egg and sperm come together. And if you look for the mutations that we think might be increasing the risk of autism for the baby, and you look back in the mom and the dad, you don't see them because they weren't there. It happened after the recombination. So, again, I think the good news is that we're learning all this information, but the bad news is that, as we learn more, autism keeps getting more and more complex.
My guest is David Amaral. He's professor of psychiatry and director of research at the UC Davis Mind Institute. We're talking about autism today. 614-292-8513. That's the number to call if you have a question or comment for David Amaral. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, France and Greece vote out austerity. We'll look at what their elections mean for Europe's debt crisis and the world. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
And On Point is this afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. 66 degrees with cloudy skies in downtown Columbus. Expect a few rain showers early in the day today, and then cloudy skies and a high of 73. Clouds for tonight, a low of 52 degrees. There's a chance of showers on Wednesday, then partly sunny skies and a high of 70. Mostly cloudy Wednesday night and milder, a low of 43 degrees. More sunshine on Thursday, a high of 67. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
We're talking about autism research and breakthroughs in autism research with Dr. David Amaral. He's professor of psychiatry and director of research at UC Davis Mind Institute. He is also past president of the International Society for Autism Research. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. William, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. Hi, William. Okay. Well, William wanted to ask about the, David wanted to ask about the increase in the incidence of autism. We know the latest research has shown that it's 1 in 88 overall children born today could be born with autism, and then among boys, 1 in 54.
Yeah, and that, you know, again, it's a sort of a complicated issue because people are more aware of what autism is. Diagnosticians are better at detecting it. It's clear that some people who, as I mentioned earlier, have, mental retardation plus autism, 20 years ago may have been given a diagnosis of mental retardation and the autism may have been ignored. But the reality is that the Center for Disease Control that continues to monitor autism continues to get higher and higher numbers. So, over the last 10 years, it's gone from 150 to 110 to 1 in 88 using similar diagnostic procedures. So, I think many in the field, although it's still debatable, many in the field would say certainly there has been an increase in the number of kids nowadays that are diagnosed with autism, but the exact increase over the last, say, 50 years or even the last 20 years is pretty difficult. In California, we have a public health care system that has been monitoring the number of children that are in families that seek services for autism, and the number has gone up really dramatically, 600% or so in the last 20 years. And my colleague here at the Mind Institute, Irva Hertz-Pachoto, and her students have tried to figure out, how many, what a portion of that percentage could be accounted for by artifacts like better awareness or change in diagnostic features. And the bottom line is that you can account for some of those artifacts, but you can't account for all of them. And it leads us to believe that there really has been an increase in the number of kids with autism. And so if that's true, and as I mentioned earlier, there's increased evidence now that at least some of the risk of autism is coming from environmental factors, it becomes even more important to try and figure out what those environmental factors are. And, I think this is one of the changes that's taken place in autism research. 15 years ago, I think people were not all that interested in surveying environmental factors that might be contributing. That's changed, and I think people are putting a lot more credibility in that kind of research.
David, there's for a long time been controversy about vaccinations and the relationship between vaccines and autism. Anything new on that front in the recent research?
Well, I think the issue is that there still is not any substantial evidence that vaccines are causing autism. I think that there have been a number of epidemiological studies And if, even though some have been criticized, there's sufficient evidence out there that would indicate that if vaccines were really the culprit, that we would be able to detect that relationship, and we haven't been able to detect it. Others have been concerned that some of the components of vaccines, like the thimerosal, which is a mercury derivative, that they may be what was causing it. But those have been removed from pediatric vaccines, and still the numbers keep going up. So my own view is that the evidence really isn't there to blame vaccines. And, you know, I wish it were that easy, because what we're really trying to do is, again, identify something that is leading to the increases. If it were as simple as vaccines, vaccine policy could be changed, and we could stem the tide of autism, but the evidence just isn't that strong. On the other hand, what I think the vaccine issue has brought to the forefront is that there may be disturbances in immune function in more generally, and that those disturbances in immune function might actually be one cause of autism. Going even back to the 1970s, people thought and knew that at least a subset of children with autism have problems with their immune system. And again, that sort of became on the fringe a little bit in the late 1990s, but there's been a resurgence because we now know that the brain and the immune system are constantly interacting, and chemicals that the immune system signals, inflammatory responses, affect how the brain functions. We found, for example, I have a colleague here at the Mind Institute, Judy Vandewater, who discovered that autism, at least a component of autism, might be an autoimmune disease. She's found that about 12% of women who have children with autism have unusual antibodies that are directed against the fetal brain. Normally, antibodies are good for you because they protect you from bacteria and viruses, but sometimes they are directed against yourself in things like rheumatoid arthritis, which is called an autoimmune disease. Well, Judy's found that about 12% of women, for reasons that we don't know, are producing antibodies that are directed at the fetal brain. My colleagues and I have then done the experiment of trying to purify those antibodies from mothers who have children with autism and put them in an animal model to see whether they might actually be causing symptoms of autism in the offspring of this animal model. And it turns out in a paper we published in 2008, we have seen that the antibodies seem to induce components of autism in an animal model. This would suggest that there's a lot more work to do, of course, but if we were able to fully identify that these antibodies are what are causing one form of autism, they're relatively easy to detect, and there are methods for blunting the effect of those antibodies. So we're excited about this line of work because we think that it actually may be one pathway to future prevention of at least a portion of autism.
Just joining us this hour, we're talking about autism. My guest is David Amaral. He's professor of psychiatry and director of research at UC Davis Mind Institute. David, many parents of children with autism want to know the likelihood of having another child with autism. This year, there was the largest study of infants with one or more older siblings on the autism spectrum. What did we learn from that?
This was a study, a multi-site study that was led by my colleague Sally Ozanoff. And what she found was that if you have one child with autism, the probability that your next child will have autism is about 20%. And it was different if the next child was going to be a boy or a girl. If it was going to be a boy, it was around 26%. If it was a girl, it was going to be about 9%. This is actually a bit higher than the earlier literature had suggested. And again, we don't know what it is that leads to that increased risk, but those were the numbers.
And also prenatal vitamins before and after conception have been found to perhaps decrease autism risks.
Yeah, that's a very exciting finding. So, of course, hopefully not all of the research is sort of doom and gloom. We really do want to find things that are beneficial. And this was a study done, again, by my colleague here, Irva Hertz-Bachoto, and her students. She's running a very large epidemiological study in California where parents or families are invited to participate. They are given detailed questionnaires about all kinds of things of their that go on in their lives. And what Irva is trying to do is associate both positive and negative things that the families have done with the risk of autism. And what she found was that for those women apparently were anticipating a pregnancy and started to take prenatal vitamins 2 to 3 months before the pregnancy occurred, there was actually a substantial decrease in the risk of having a child with autism. So, this, I think, is a very positive thing that can be done, and it would be the kind of thing that, a woman anticipating a pregnancy would want to discuss with her physicians. But it's a relatively benign, positive thing. And again, the mechanism for how the prenatal vitamins prior to pregnancy reduces the risk is not clear. But what's interesting in that study was that it turned out that certain women who had particular genetic background seemed to benefit more than others. So it may be that the prenatal vitamins were compensating for a sort of very mild metabolic problem that the woman had.
John in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, John.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
Good. I was just wondering if there's any tendency for hyperdiagnosis, like overdiagnosing, because you say that the diagnosis has been increasing in recent years. Is there any way that that maybe there should be, more focus on breaking down the spectrum into categories like familiar with Asperger's? I guess my question is, are there any other, ranges that are more focused and more defined? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, John, thank you.
John, that's a really good question. And, I think people are trying to find biological reasons for defining subtypes. I sometimes, when I'm talking to lay audiences, will relate it to cancer. Cancer is a big general term, and we know that different cancers are caused by by different genetic environmental factors. We don't work any longer on cancer generally. We work on breast cancer or lung cancer or whatever. So I think that there's a huge search going on to define different biological subtypes of autism. I'll give you an example. There's one of the biological features of autism when you're looking at the development of the brain is that some children seem to have a too rapid growth of their brain. And this is in the period between birth and about 3 to 4 years of age. The brain in some kids with autism, if you look at their growth curve compared to typically developing kids, the brain is really growing too fast, and we don't think that's a good thing because the brain is really like a symphony, and everything has to be working in the right time. But it turns out we've done a very large study now of about 300 families and done MRIs on the children in all those families, and what we find is that only about 10% of children with autism have the rapidly growing brains. The remainder either have brains that are growing at the normal rate, or there's a small subset that actually have brains that grow too slowly. So, we wonder, well, what's the difference in the autism between the kids who have the rapidly growing brains from those that have the normal growing brains? And there's other features like that will define subtypes. What's happening diagnostically, on the other hand, is that it's been really difficult to draw clear boundaries just on behavioral definitions between something like Asperger and high-functioning autism. So where things are going in the field is that We're going to start using the term autism spectrum disorder to encompass everybody who has the symptoms of autism, and not try and at least behaviorally define subtypes like Asperger, or there's another one called PDD-NOS that's very vague. That's the direction the field is going at this point.
This September, scientists at University of California, L.A. developed a new mouse that may represent a more useful animal model for studying autism spectrum disorder and testing potential treatments. Is this a big deal?
You know, it is. There isn't really a good animal model of autism at this point in time, and there's still debates about, you know, which species would be the best species. But in that study, what they did was they took one of these genes that we know increases the risk of autism, and mutated it in a mouse model. And what was interesting is that the mouse did show all of the three kinds of impairments that we use to diagnose autism. So once you've done that, then you can try a variety of drug therapies or other kinds of therapies to try and reduce those symptoms. So the development of an animal model will certainly speed up attempts to come to terms with, better therapies. We don't have a drug really at this point that is directed at treating the core symptoms of autism. And, you know, so that's an area for rapid growth in the future.
Sarah in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Sarah.
Hi, thanks for having me on. First, I just wanted to say thank you for having this discussion, because I think it's important to talk about autism a lot for people to understand what's going on. But we just got a diagnosis for our three-year-old son, an autism diagnosis, actually last week. And my trying to explain this to family members has been a little bit of a challenge, especially some of them that, you know, maybe haven't accompanied us to an appointment or haven't looked at all of the research that I've done. But how do I try to break this down to my father-in-law, who hasn't really a clue what this is and thinks that, you know, his grandson is perfectly fine? He just doesn't, you know, he's 3 years old and just doesn't talk.
David Amaral?
You know, I know that it's a difficult thing to do. And I think the way to explain it is that, it is really a medical problem. It is, for reasons that, again, are not entirely clear, the brain of your son is having some problems accomplishing what it should be accomplishing, like language or making social contact. And these, left uncorrected, left untreated, will make it harder for your son to get along in life. And that's why it's important to get an early diagnosis to try and get therapy for your son, which can certainly decrease, his ultimate disability substantially. The good news is that behavior therapy does work. For many, many children with autism, it does decrease disability. It actually raises an important issue, and that is, I think many people who are on the autism spectrum are now speaking out about the need to understand this disability, this problem. I mean, all of us have things that we would like to make better in ourselves, and people with autism have disabilities, but oftentimes they have many abilities that are precious. Many people with autism are terrific artists. Many people with autism are fantastic engineers and computer programmers. So, there is a current in autism that suggests that we shouldn't necessarily be knee-jerk trying to change a person with autism, but we should understand them and accept them. And I think, again, it's an issue about the spectrum. If for a child that's 13 and still not potty trained and, has a lot of self-injurious behaviors, certainly we want to do something to try and help that child decrease disability. But for a person that is on the spectrum but is having maybe difficulties with social interaction or holding a job or developing a relationship, you know, I think the kinds of intervention we want to do for that child, that individual, is the same kind of thing that many of us do in terms of getting psychotherapy to make us better individuals. So it's complicated.
Sarah, thanks a lot for your call. Thank you, David Amaral, for joining us today. We appreciate it.
And it's been a pleasure chatting with you and your listeners.
David Amaral, he's professor of psychiatry and director of research at UC Davis Mind Institute. Coming up, we're going to turn the conversation to the issue of Fragile X syndrome. If you have a question or comment about Fragile X syndrome, give us a call, 614-292-8513. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Looking for an easy way to support 89.7 NPR News? How about joining our Sustaining Giving Program? As a sustainer, your membership never expires. No more reminders in the mail, and your WOSU member card renews annually. The ongoing support of sustaining members saves 89.7 NPR News time and money and helps us focus more of your support on news programming. Make every dollar count and become a sustainer today. Visit WOSU.org/sustainer to sign up.
This is 89.7 NPR News. Stay right here in 20 minutes. At 11 o'clock, it's Tech Tuesday, a discussion of social media, gadgetry, and the use of holograms. Stay with us for Tech Tuesday from 11 till noon on 89.7 NPR News. And you can always discover more about All Sides with Ann Fisher at WOSU.org/allsides. On the show's website, you can listen and watch the show live every day from 10 until noon and participate in the show through our live chat. Also, be sure to like All Sides on Facebook and follow Ann on Twitter at AnnFisherWOSU. 66 degrees in downtown Columbus. Cloudy skies today. There is a chance of a little bit of rain, mainly before 2 o'clock this afternoon, a high of 73. Mostly cloudy for tonight, a low of 52 degrees. There's a chance of rain on Wednesday, otherwise partly sunny, and a milder day, a high of 70 degrees. Clouds Wednesday night, a low of 43. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Fragile X syndrome is the most common inherited cause of intellectual disabilities and the most common known cause of autism. It affects 1 in 4,000 males and 1 in 6,000 females. Although it is one of the most common genetic diseases in humans, most people with Fragile X are not yet correctly diagnosed. A May 7th Newsweek story about parents of children with special needs highlighted Mississippi Representative Greg Harper and his 22-year-old son who has Fragile X syndrome. Greg said he heard a long list of what could go wrong when his son was diagnosed 18 years ago, but he and his wife decided they weren't going to accept that. That's pretty much the situation with Judith Maloney these days. With her husband, she has two boys with Fragile X. She fundraises for the Fraxa Research Foundation and believes there is hope on the horizon. Welcome to the show, Judith.
Thanks, Ann. Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Mark Baer. He's a professor of neuroscience at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Department of Brain and Cognitive Sciences in Chevy Chase, Maryland. He joins us by phone from Boston. Welcome to the show, Mark Baer.
Good morning, Ann and Judith.
Good morning, Mark.
Mark, you're not an autism researcher, but you have identified the molecular malfunction behind Fragile X syndrome. Tell us about the malfunction.
Well, you know, the primary cause of Fragile X is a mutation of a gene called the FMR1 gene, and the failure of that gene to produce the gene product, which is a protein called FMRP. And over the years, it's become clear that the FMRP protein normally puts the brakes on new protein synthesis at synapses in the brain. And sort of an independent line of research has shown that one of the main drivers of protein synthesis at synapses in the brain is a neurotransmitter receptor. And what we've discovered is if we inhibit that neurotransmitter receptor, we can restore normal balance of protein synthesis in the brain and restore a lot of functions, at least in the animal models of Fragile X.
As a result of your discovery, several drugs that could correct the disorder are now in clinical trials. What do we mean by correcting Fragile X syndrome, or the disorder Fragile X?
Well, sort of the early insight about this, if you want to call it a signaling imbalance or a metabolic problem at the synapse, was that this one problem could account for many, many symptoms of the disease. So the disease is associated not only with intellectual disability and autistic-like behaviors, but also altered gastrointestinal function and anxiety disorder and many other aspects. And what was exciting about this insight was that it appeared to provide a thread that could connect these widely varying symptoms of the disease. So if it's a problem of essentially metabolism at the synapse and we have a way of restoring that to a normal balance, then potentially we could correct many of those symptoms of the disease. And that's what the drug studies have shown so far in the animals.
So, Judith Maloney, you have two boys with Fragile X. Tell us a little bit about them. And when you hear about these sorts of prospects, you know, what it does to the community that you belong to in Central Ohio.
Well, Anne, as you mentioned, I have two boys with Fragile X. Nolan is 11 and Liam will be 14 in 2 weeks. They have been involved in numerous therapies since they were 2 years old and 7 months old. And I've seen great improvements in their abilities, yet they still have a lot of struggles. Their speech is very delayed, fine and gross motor skills very delayed. Learning is an issue. You know, they struggle with schoolwork, are way below grade level, and have a lot of anxiety issues, like Mark mentioned earlier, the gastrointestinal issues. There's a whole bevy of problems that they have. So when you hear about the prospect of a potential drug treatment to resolve a lot of these issues, and from what I've read, I believe also will allow them to catch up on some of the learning that they haven't been able to achieve so far. It's very exciting.
Now, neither of your boys are enrolled in any of the studies.
They are not currently. We've been looking at one at Rush Presbyterian.
How do you, as a parent of two children with Fragile X, how do you decide what kind of therapies to try?
That's a good question. I mean, obviously identify their needs. Speech is very obvious. And so they've been in that continually since they were very little. You rely a lot on teachers and other therapists to help you realize some of the struggles they're having and to make recommendations. And then other parents as well. Networking with them has been a huge help to me, and I know to a lot of the other parents I know with children with Fragile X, sharing what's been successful, what hasn't been, and learning what's available out there as well.
Mark Beer, what do we know about these kinds of clinical trials and how they operate?
Well, the I think that there's a very, very strong scientific foundation for these clinical trials. So I just want to say again that there's been a lot of animal research in models of Fragile X. One of the advantages we have with Fragile X is that the same gene mutation that causes the disease in humans can be reproduced in a mouse or in a fruit fly or a number of different organisms. And we can use those animal models to study what's wrong or what's different in the brain. And this is what's laid the foundation for these treatments that are now going into clinical trials. So they're extremely well grounded in the science. The problem is that how a mutation manifests in a fly or a mouse is going to be different than how it manifests in a human. And so at that level, we don't have much guidance from the animal studies about what would be the best symptom domain to study to look for an effect of a drug treatment. So a lot of the early clinical trials are casting a very broad net to try to detect any signal that shows a benefit from the treatment. And so far, we only have preliminary data, and more studies are underway now. But the preliminary data look exciting and promising. And one of the symptom domains that appears to be responding is the domain of social avoidance, which is one of the core symptom domains of autism.
Could this be applied at all to other forms of autism, Mark Baer?
Well, we certainly hope so. As was mentioned previously, Fragile X is still the leading known inherited cause of autism, even though it only accounts for a few percent. But what we hope is that there'll be many causes of autism that converge on a similar disruption of synapses in the brain, and disruptions that can potentially be corrected by the same treatment approaches. So the hope is that indeed the insights we've gained by studying Fragile X will apply much more broadly.
Luke in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Luke.
Hi. My question is, as I was listening to this morning, the symptoms pretty much describe my son exactly. And I've been to a couple of doctors, and they've assured me that there's nothing wrong. But I can't get over the repetitive motion, repetitive noise making, lining up of cars, even as the doctor said. And I wondered, is there a specialist that I can go to, or is there some kind of, I don't know how to ask, but it seems like the doctors don't want to believe that you're concerned about it. Whenever I went to these doctors, they really just didn't seem concerned. Like it, and I tried to describe them, and on a couple of different occasions, that I really think this is a problem, and I don't know how to get help is what I'm really getting at.
Judith Maloney, tell us a little bit about your experience when you first discovered your older boy, and then probably your next boy.
Sure.
Might have it.
Excuse me.
And Luke, hang on, okay?
Okay.
Hi, Luke.
Hi.
It can be very frustrating in the beginning trying to sort out all the symptoms and to have someone take it seriously. And we were fortunate that our pediatrician, while he kind of delayed making any kind of diagnosis at first, he did kind of jump on the bandwagon pretty quickly and say, okay, I agree, there's an issue. Getting to the Fragile X diagnosis did not come through him, however. I think, you know, down at Nationwide Children's Hospital, there's an autism center there that would probably be a good place to start. There's also the Neisonger Center at OSU. We have visited both of those. The Fragile X test is a very simple blood test, just a blood draw, and then they check the DNA, and you can get a diagnosis one way or the other. I think that most physicians, from what I hear from other parents now, are doing this test when there's any type of delay noted in a young child. So I would, I guess, suggest going to one of those two places and having a developmental specialist look at your son.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, Luke, take care.
Thank you.
Mike in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Hi. Back in the mid-90s, we had teachers suggest that we take two of my sons and get them, actually the older son, and there was something developmentally wrong. We went down to Children's Hospital, a geneticist ran some lab work, and it came back negative for Fragile X. Her comment was, all the symptoms are there. She would bet anything that they were Fragile X, but at the time, the test, apparently there are different, different things on the genes that they have not been able to identify all strains of Fragile X. At the time, her comment was, come back in a few years and we may be able to identify it. Well, my wife and I just figured we're going to treat the symptoms. And they were been in special needs classes. I'm wondering what, if there is anything new to positively identify it, or if you understand my question.
Mark Baer, can you address that question?
I'll do my best. So Fragile X is caused by a very specific disruption of this gene. Now, I'm not sure that all the gene tests can pick up every disruption that affects the gene, but in any case, what we believe is that this gene disruption is part of this gene is part of a molecular machine at synapses, and there are other cogs in that machine that can be disrupted and cause symptoms that appear like Fragile X and autism. And I think we're at a very rapid pace. We're learning more and more about different gene disruptions that lead to these sorts of symptoms. In fact, there was a paper that just published last week that identified hundreds of mutations in genes that associate with autism. And what was very interesting was that many of those gene products associated with the FMRP, that is the protein that's missing in Fragile X. So there's a suspicious coincidence that many of these disruptions seem to be converging on the same biochemical pathway. So what I'm saying is that even though your son may not have the classical mutation that causes Fragile X, they still may have a disruption in the same signaling pathway, and on a hopeful note, may still respond to the treatments that are being developed for Fragile X.
Mike, take care.
Thank you.
Well, Mark Beer, I want to say thank you for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
It was a pleasure.
Mark Beer is a professor of neuroscience at MIT and an investigator at the Howard Hughes Medical Center. Also, Judith Maloney, parent of two sons with Fragile X syndrome. Judith, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Anne.
You do fundraising for an organization, a parent-run organization, Fraxa?
Correct.
You just raised a bunch of money a few weeks ago.
We did last week. We don't have the final count. Somewhere between $65,000 and $75,000 will go directly towards Fragile X research
because it's a parent-run organization.
It's a parent-run organization that has very low overhead, and they're able to fund approximately 96% of all their proceeds directly toward research.
If you want to learn more about that, you can go to our website at wosu.org/allsides. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.